don't believe bios really. No, I'm not working on the fourth draft, the first draft of the novel at all. So I had this idea I would be, but it's not happening. So short stories is what I love apart from poetry. It's great to be here. This is inspired by Seamus Heaney's poem Postscript. Flight. Sometime in June or July, throw on a cable-stitched grey jumper or even a thick coat for warmth. Take the afternoon off and head out past Cornell to Cape Solander. There, on the white sandstone cliffs above the vast sprawl of the sea, look for humpbacks heading north, swimming near the shore to dodge the ocean current sliding south. Witness, if you're lucky, a whale breaching. The corrugated whiteness of its wobbly ascension, the dark certainty and blazing glitter of its fall. The cold breeze ruffles the diamond quilt until it's as messy as an unmade bed. It tugs at the waving tendrils of seagrass and at the tips of your ears. It makes your eyes water as if some old sandus has unexpectedly taken hold. You can find no sign of a sea eagle hovering. You cannot name the endangered species growing in this headland heath. But you can close your eyes. You decide to do this simple thing, electing to completely miss the whale if it rises again, aware now of this immense unknown life going on around you, within you, as the buffeting, lunging wind picks you up and gives you wings. I went to school, I don't know if this happens in Ireland, but when I went to school, we used to have football training after school twice a week, and ballroom dancing once a week, and it was hard to pick the difference between them, really. This is called fancy footwork. Ballroom dancing was held in gym. Take your partner in the waltz hold, gentlemen, meant win the ball at all costs. And pilots came naturally to boys used to hunting in packs. No oranges. But once we were dragged out back for a pep talk, and our comeback rivaled the day Fred Astaire kicked 10 from the forward flank. But my favourite was when Chicken Legs Christine managed to break loose while dancing the Galloping Gordon and streaming up the wing in her pink taffeta gown. She evaded 5 tackles, executed a blind turn on the head of a sixpence, and unleashed a spiralling torpedo punt that sent me sailing through the goalposts in 6-8 time. I had a request for this poem, so I'm going to read it. I wasn't planning to. Closest I'll ever get to being a rock singer, I'm sure, or to a rock singer's income. Now, I should explain that that fibro is a really cheap building material that they make houses of in Australia. It's useless. It's very hot in summer, very cold in winter. There's an epigraph to this poem from American poet Robert Hass, which reads, I'm a little ashamed that I want to end this poem singing. Joy and a fibro shack. The difficulty of writing a poem is like the difficulty of building a house without a plan, wood, a hammer. You have to start somewhere. And if you have a tin of nails, then that's as good a place as any. The foundations, the frame, and the finish will come if you work at it, or might not come. There's always the canvas shell of a tent. There's always driftwood and burlap fastened with bamboo vines. There's always the music of corrugated iron in a hailstorm or its blistering shade at midday. Is a poem a palace or a humpy? I prefer humpies, furnished with a daggy couch reclaimed from the council cleanup. I want to capture the grit beneath fingernails, the mysterious gaze of a brush wattle bird peering at me through the window, the misery of a broken marriage, and the elation of the night we bumped into Rebecca at Kilimanjaro, the restaurant, not the mountain. Crammed around the table as those first contractions took hold of her body. Breath, heartbeat, blood, the nervous dash to the hospital. Then screams, far too loud, far too long for the sanitized labour of soap opera. They call it overacting. They call it amateur. They'd say it was in very bad taste. I prefer poems to come into the world shining with phoenix, green with meconium, radiant with the open-eyed awe of a baby in the first half hour of her life, while the wind lifts and rattles the walls until the house resonates with its own bright keening. Like the night I was up at 3 a.m, walking the kitchen, walking the hallway, walking the lounge room, holding a baby who would not stop, just would not stop crying. Thank you. Oh, this is a Melbourne poem. 3 a.m. Along High Street, the window in the white cortina, right down, the air rushing in, my foot on the accelerator, beating time to the electric fizz of Johnny B. Good. All evening, my hand inside your jumper. What bliss. Streetlights flashing past like beacons of joy. Everything went so well until you found Jesus. It never works after that. But when you said, if you ask Jesus into your life, you'll never miss another green light or wait for a parking space, I couldn't help myself. I said, 2,000 years and all it amounts to is traffic flow? And you gave me that look. And I knew, Eli, Eli, it is finished. Yeah, Love Gone Wrong are kind of the best sources for poetry. I'm a big fan of William Morris, too, as an English socialist poet, interior decorator, novelist, etc., etc. And his doctor actually said he died from being William Morris and living the life of 10 men. I was at Cove today and I was reminded how hunger is very significant in the history of this country. This is called The Colour of Starvation. I cannot remember the details anymore, what it was that moved me. I was watching this film in year 11 at school, a documentary set somewhere in Africa or India where many people were poor and starving. The film was long and carried over into lunchtime when everyone else left, except for a couple of do-gooders. Sucks, they called us. I was so moved. I went home that evening and told my parents to sell their house so we could all give up this life of decadence. Yet, I'll be 45 in a month and I am no closer to renouncing decadence. Where has my idealism gone? And why, like a jump cut in a movie, do I suddenly think of William Morris, who said you can build a bonfire with 9/10 of a rich man's belongings? Not that Morris was opposed to possessions. He loved useful, decorative, beautifully made things. He was only against the enjoyment of an object that had been a pain and a grief for its maker to make. Morris believed in the fulfillment of workers. He abhorred the numbing boredom of the production line. I see him wearing sabots and a smock, standing next to the dyeing vat which is sunk into the earth. He has mixed madder with wild mignonette, so his gold silk, when laid out in a long, rich hank, has the captivating glow of a sunset. Morris didn't like colours to appear starved, just as he hated the obscenity of starvation, recruiting apprentices from the industrial home for destitute boys. I don't know if he'd have stayed to the end of the film, but I'm sure he'd have had something to say. For a long time, I've had this idea that I would write about a woman with six children who works 14 hours a day in a factory with no windows. But what use would it be if I managed to convey the tiring glare of the fluorescent lights and the nagging ache in her lower back, or found words to mime the unceasing drone of the singer, 24 garments an hour, 6 days a week? And what if, after labouring over the poem, I went to bed with the contented weariness that comes from worrying over the warp and weft of a single phrase? It's easy to formulate the questions, much harder to live the answers. Rising with the dew still on the windfall apples, Morris eats 5 eggs for breakfast, dips his toast into his tea, and looks out onto his garden city, the day already stretching out as sunlight streams through the window. Like the American poet Sharon Olds, I occasionally work off photos, so this was based on a photo. The Festival of Kites. Everyone's on the roof. The revelers' shadows ripple like saris drying by the river. Two women sit on the cool corrugated iron and watch as a girl spins a stick, the mango-shaped ball of twine working down to its seed. On the other wall, a boy gazes after the string, his heel lifting as if he might step over the edge, his left side a perfect fluid line, arm bent at the elbow, the long dark fingers of his free hand clutching at air, his face all innocence and rapture. Above him, the kite flares up, becomes a white peacock strutting the sky. My book's called Out to Lunch, and I took the title from a series where I have lunch with characters from books like Atticus Finch and Captain Ahab and Madame Bovary and, anyone I want to, really. Does anyone here go to uni? Yeah? Okay, so this is for you. This is from a sequence called Out to Lunch, and it's called Skippy. Oh, I should say, Raskolnikov is, of course, the hero or the main character of Dostoevsky's novel Crime and Punishment. This is called Skipping Lectures with Raskolnikov. I choose a table in the centre of the cafe, surrounded by empty tables. For Raskolnikov has a dread of overhearing conversations. He is as thin as unleavened bread and sits down without taking his coat off, despite the summer heat. I'm disappointed, because I'd hoped to examine the loop sewn under his left armpit where he hid the axe. I'd like to experience what it's like to walk the streets while concealing a murder weapon. I order a pot of Earl Grey tea to share and raisin toast with thickly spread butter. His beautiful dark eyes stare at me. He can't seem to sit still and gets up to leave 5 times before the toast arrives. I tell him how university students now congregate on Facebook, but he is suspicious of fads and can't understand how they can take out loans they don't have to pay back for years. He has suddenly become garrulous, talking with his mouth full and revealing that he never would have gone through with it, but that Dostoevsky needed a murder to make his novel work and needed a novel to support his gambling habit. Raskolnikov still seems famished and pale, so I order another serve of raisin toast and ask him about the cold of Siberia. His eyes light up and he's off again, and the afternoon opens out before us like the Russian steppes. I have a lecture to give, I tell Raskolnikov, but I'm hoping no one will notice, least of all the students, if I don't bother to turn up. I've lived for the last few years with some vegetarians. Hang on. Put the bloody glass down before you start an introduction next time. And so I decided, really, I think it got me writing about meat. And I decided, what I've done is rewritten a number of famous poems and the beginning of one novel to put more meat in them. So this is from a sequence called Meat Matters, The Humble Sausage. I wandered lonely as a sausage without a slice of bread. Shall I compare thee to a bratwurst roll? One whiff of garlic and I lose control. Sausage, sausage, flaming bright on this sticky summer night. Your casing gapes, your insides burst. If only I'd parboiled you first. So much depends upon a red Frankfurt squirted with tomato sauce lying in a roll. I will arise and go now and go to the charcuterie. 9 varieties they have there of beef and lamb and pork. I shall buy a dozen each. What joy, what glee to see them browning in the pan, to pierce them with a fork. In the room, the women come and go, munching on cappuccino. But I see nothing, nothing, only sausages. 5 sausages in a tray. Byron loved his mortadella as much as any other fella. Call me chorizo. I'd like to say thanks very much to Paul and thanks very much to Paul and Mari for their tremendous hospitality, and also to the embassy for their support. I'll just finish with this poem, which is set in Kashan in Iran. It's called The Carpet Weaver. Every day Azra walked to her uncle's workshop to weave rugs too precious to walk on. Carpets destined for America or Paris, where they might adorn polished floorboards or be proudly hung on the walls of the billiard room. At 7, Azra learnt how to beat down the threads with a heavy iron comb. At 9, she graduated to the loom, her long, nimble fingers tying the centre knot as tight and as tiny as her uncle required. You can learn the history of a tribe from rugs, her uncle liked to say, their wars, their religion and culture, even their decadence. All day, Azra bent over the loom, carrying a jumble of colours and knots in her head. A prince with a falcon clinging to his wrist, a tiger stalking the spotted ibex. All day, she laboured in a windowless room that was hot, stuffy. Sometimes the children's voices mingled and pealed like goat's bells. Sometimes there was only the sound of their breathing, the pliant silk, the wind made by the speed of their fingers. Occasionally, a girl would brag of her accomplishment and they'd count knots or race to tie off the last thread in the green eye of a dragon. At 18, the doctor tells Azra that her pelvis is so small, so misshapen, that it will surely crush a baby's skull. When the time comes, she must have a cesarean section. If only I could get that far, she thinks, as she takes the bloody pad out of her underwear. Her weaving has led to this, just as the path leads to the hammam, the bazaar, the mosque. Tonight, Azra will cry as she tells her husband that their boy. She doesn't know why, but she thinks that the baby as a boy is lost, like the last one. There will be no turquoise gems, no new rug, no days of sunlight and birdsong, no table laden with food and refreshments. There will be no need to count the weeks, no cause to stack the swaddling cloths in a corner of their home. There's no point trying again, she thinks. I am as helpless as a silkworm boiled in its own cocoon. Thank you for listening.